This is an interview with Daryl Smeaton, who worked as a senior private secretary to two ministers between 1987 and 1994, and he also had other connections with Old Parliament House prior to this period. Daryl will be speaking with me, Edward Helgeby, for the oral history program conducted by the Museum of Australian Democracy at Old Parliament House. On behalf of the director of the museum, I would like to thank you for agreeing to participate in this program. Do you understand that the Commonwealth owns copyright in the interview material, but disclosure will be subject to any disclosure restrictions you impose in completing the rights agreement?
I do.
This being so, may we have your permission to make a transcript or a summary of this recording should we decide to make one?
Yes.
This interview is taking place today on the 25th of February 2013 at 10:30 a.m. Can we begin with little bit of background on your parents and when and where you were born, attended school and so forth?
Well, I was born on the 8th of December 1949 in Ballarat, Victoria. I am the ninth child of Robert and Jesse Smeaton. I went to school in Ballarat and they were at variously convent schools, St. Aloysius, Christian Brothers Middle School and St. Patrick's College. And just before I turned 18, I came to Canberra.
Right. So you actually came to Canberra in about
1967.
Talk a little bit about your career up to the time you became senior private secretary to the Minister for Justice in 1987.
Okay, well, that was a 20-year career almost in the public service, starting in the office of the Commissioner for Trade Practices, which was the first Trade Practices Commission after the passage of trade practices legislation. I then moved to the Attorney General's Department and moved from Civic to the Administration Building just across the road from Old Parliament House. And in the Attorney General's Department, I did a number of jobs, one of which was the Parliamentary Liaison Officer job, which I guess we'll talk about a little later. I then moved to a number of places, the Department of Labor and National Service. And then in 1972, with the change of 1973, in actual fact, in the first year of the Whitlam government, I moved to the Department of the Special Minister of State, which brought me into close contact with ministers in particular, because it was the first time, I think, that a single department provided all of the ministerial services to ministers and their staffs. That proceeded for probably 3 or 4 years, I think. It would have been less than that because the government changed in 1975. I think the Department of the Special Minister of State morphed into an administrative services department.
Okay. Can we, before we move on from there, could you talk a little bit more about your role as departmental liaison officer from Attorney General or AG's department?
Yes, well, it sounds quite wonderful, except that I was in those days a clerk class 4, but I essentially worked as the liaison between the secretary of the department, who was Clary Harders in those days, and the Attorney General of the time, Senator Ivor Greenwood. And my task was a physical and personal liaison. Every day that Parliament was in session, I would come over to the House of Representatives side door, straight through, of course, there was no security or anything of that kind, and go into Senator Greenwood's office and liaise with his longtime personal secretary, Pat O'Connor, and I picked up correspondence and submissions that the minister had seen and signed. I took them back to the department and personally delivered them to the secretary of the department, and we would sit down and he would personally mark the correspondence to an officer within the Attorney General's department. I would deliver those and ultimately I'd get a reply back, and that was the cycle of parliamentary liaison. And it was a very interesting time compared with later years, obviously.
Yeah. And what about the job you had in ministerial services, servicing the Special Minister for State?
Yes, well, it was, as I said, I think it was the first time that government decided to bring services to ministers and their staffs together into one department. I think hitherto each department looked after their respective minister and his or her staff. And of course, we're not talking about the huge numbers of staff that we now have. I would think that there were probably five or six people in a senior minister's staff. There were two or three in a junior minister's staff, and then the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Government in the Senate, etc., would have had more substantial staffs, but not great numbers, I can assure you. So what I did in SMOS, as we called it, Special Minister of State, was I set up with a group of people a personnel and salary section. So we brought together all of the staffs under each minister, and we actually paid the ministers and those staffs through the Special Minister of State salary system. And it also involved looking after ministerial travel. So we didn't actually do anything around the purpose of the travel, but rather just did all of the arrangements, the bookings, and the preparation of travel allowance and that sort of thing. And that was quite an interesting side of the work, because we used to provide the minister with a travel allowance, and we gave the minister traveller's checks. So myself and an officer from the Commonwealth Bank used to go to visit the minister before the minister left the country, and got him or her, well, I think it was always him in those days, to, as you might recall, you used to have to countersign the traveller's checks in the presence of a bank officer. And I did that with most people, including the Prime Minister, Gough Whitlam. I remember at least once going into his office and standing while he signed a number of checks in the presence of a Commonwealth Bank officer. And I do recall Carol Summerhayes was his personal secretary in those days. And I remember I called him at one stage Mr. Whitlam, and she later, she just admonished me by saying, you should address Mr. Whitlam as Prime Minister. And I guess the only one other sort of memory of that was with Clyde Cameron, who was the Minister for Labour and National Service. And he went on a trip, I can recall, to Japan. I think it was a week. And ministers used to get $100 a day in travelling allowance. So I went over duly and signed him up with his traveller's checks. And about 2 weeks later, it would have been, when he got back to Australia, I got a call from his office. I remember again, his senior private secretary was Milton Cockburn, who ended up being a very prominent journalist, of course, with the Sydney Morning Herald. Milton called me up and said, Darryl, he said, Clyde wants you to come over and get the money back. I was a bit nonplussed. I said, well, Milton, it's not refundable, it's not acquittable, as we don't have a process for for getting money. Oh, no, he's very insistent. So I duly went across to the office, or came across to the office, and we went into the office with Clyde, Milton and I, and Clyde said, "I've got to give you these traveller's checks back." And I said, "Well, Minister, there's no process for returning money that's..." "I didn't spend it," he said. "I went to Japan. They put me up in a guest house. I didn't have to put my hand in my pocket at all." So he said, "I can't keep it." So we took back $700 in traveller's checks, which was a first. I didn't do it. It never happened with any other minister, I can assure you.
So you had frequent, obviously, very with both these jobs, the DLO and the and to the Special Minister of State Services, you were frequent visitor to the building.
Oh, yes.
But was there ever an office of any kind that you actually used as a base?
No. Okay. Again, I was located East Block, was where the Department of the Special Minister of State was. Yeah. So it was an easy walk. I think Senator Don Willacy was the minister, the first Special Minister of State. I didn't have an office here, no. Yeah.
Tell me, what was your first impression of Old Parliament House when you first came here?
Well, of course, I don't think there was even a thought then of a new Parliament House. So it was a very impressive building, and of course, as a young man, I wouldn't say I was overawed, but I certainly, in that particular period, the Whitlam government, I think I had a thought that this was a fairly historic period, simply because it had been so long since Labor had been in power. And I remember very vividly the 2nd of December 1972, when I was actually best man at a wedding in Goulburn, and we left the wedding early to listen to the count. So that was quite an amazing period. But I think, there was... I certainly had that feeling, and I, of course, then on that time in... November, 11th of November 1975, again, still working across at East Block, and we heard about the Governor-General's actions, and I was one of many who congregated at the front, in the front of the steps, heard the official secretary prorogue the Parliament, and Mr. Whitlam's famous words, "Well, may he say, God save the Queen, because nothing will save the Governor-General."
Then you had come to Canberra a few years earlier than this, and up to this period of time, where did you actually live?
I lived for the first 4 years almost in Braddon, right behind... what was then a hostel opposite the Canberra Rex Hotel. So I lived two blocks back from Northbourne Avenue with my mother and two younger brothers. And then, as we all did in those days, as a young man, just about to turn 21, I married. And my wife and I lived very briefly in Griffith, at Stewart Flats, a government flat, as you would, most people went into. And we bought land and built in Flynn, in West Belconnen, and we've now been there for 40 years this year.
Mm. What was it like to live in Canberra in those days, from your perspective?
Well, it was interesting that I was one of those people who came to Canberra to join the public service, or had been transferred up to Canberra. So at that age, when I was 18 to 21, it was very rare to meet somebody of my age who was born in Canberra. Mm. And almost everyone that I interacted with had come from somewhere else. Mm. So, my Friday afternoon drinking group at the Canberra Rex Hotel. There were 8 or 9 of us who used to gather there for a drink on Friday night, and most of them lived in Gowrie Hostel across the road. And then I was outside work. I was a part of a Christian youth movement, the Young Christian Workers Movement, and there was, it was actually one of those places where you found your wife. it was one of those where there were mixed groups, and I met my wife through that, and we had, I suppose, what now would be regarded as a whirlwind relationship. I think we met in March 1 year, and we were married in November the next year, so it was a pretty quick, and that was often the case. And she was born in Canberra.
That was
the big, one of the big things, to actually meet somebody who was born in Canberra and then marry her.
Were you at all interested in politics at this time, and did you ever join a party?
Never joined a party. I didn't actually start university until 1972, and 74 actually, no 72, and I did a Bachelor of Arts with majors in public administration, politics and law. And I suppose that study, part-time study, certainly triggered an interest in politics. You couldn't help working in a place like Canberra. And of course, given what happened through the early 70s and Gough Whitlam, etc., I think there was a heightened, certainly in my case, a heightened interest in politics. I think that in the 70s, I was probably not... I was at, I'm trying to think of the right word. I didn't favour one party over the other. But I think 1975 certainly changed my political thinking, and I have since then, I think, been a supporter of Labor, both in terms of my voting intentions, but also I think in terms of the political philosophy I follow. But I've never joined a party.
No. Briefly, what sort of, if we fast forward from 1975 to 1987, when you became senior private secretary, can you briefly describe what you were doing in those years?
Between 75 and 87, I spent some time after the admin services experience in 75. I moved to the public service. No, where did I go? I think I went to the Department of Finance. Spent a couple of years there. Then moved to, I'd have to say, I learned how to say no in the Department of Finance, which is an interesting comment. I think we used to look after a particular group of departments and look after their budget submissions, etc. And so the Department of Finance's position was generally to I've left out the Department of Finance. I was there as a clerk class 8, clerk class 7, and then promoted to a clerk class 8, and looked after, I think, the Department of Immigration was the main department. I then went to the Public Service Board, and I spent about 3 years in the Public Service Board, possibly a little more than that, I think. I started off in areas that looked after, the sort of conditions of service of public servants and those sorts of things. We used to talk to departments about the creation of positions and jobs and all that sort of thing. And I ended up in an area called the Interchange Program, where I ran a program where public servants went to the private sector, and private sector people came into the department. And then in 1980, about 84, I think, 83 or 84, I moved to the Department of Administrative Services. And I basically worked on, again, a broad range of administrative matters, but I ended up running a program called, or looked after, the Australian Council of Young Political Leaders. It was something that was set up by Malcolm Fraser as the Prime Minister, and the chair of that group was the President of the Senate. And when I took over from Michael Bolton, who was for a long time the head of the Joint House Department, I think, up on the Capitol Hill, if not the House of Representatives. Anyway, I took over from him and ran that program, working with a bipartisan group of politicians. So Senator Douglas McClellan, the chair, the president of the Senate, was the co-chair with Sir Robert Cotton. And there was somebody from the Labor Party and somebody from the Liberal Party and somebody from the Democrats who made up that group. And basically it was involved with the American, same sort of group in America, and a group in China, and it grew for a bit. I was there for a couple of years, but we used to take groups of young Australian politicians to America for a couple of weeks, quite often during an election period and that sort of thing. I think I took two groups to America and one to China, and hosted two groups from the United States in Australia. And we used to focus on political issues. I remember a Queensland election that we observed where J.B. Elkey-Peterson was opposed by Keith Wright as the opposition, Labor opposition leader. And we looked at the campaign in Brisbane, where we saw both J.B. Elkey-Peterson and Keith Wright do their final speeches to the press club. And I think seven of the eight young American politicians were absolutely certain that Keith Wright was going to win the election. And a young potato farmer from Idaho, whose name I forget, but he said, "Oh, no, Mr. Bjelke-Petersen, he'll win, or he's the best." And of course he did. Mm. So it was that sort of thing. I then moved from that program into, would have been late 86, to an area that looked after royal commissions within admin services.
Well, that was actually just before the main event, so to speak.
Yes.
And that's the one that I'd like to focus on now. They became senior private secretary to the Minister for Justice. I think the date you gave was September 87 that happened. Did you apply for the job, or were you approached to apply for the job?
Well,
how did it happen?
I think that Michael Tait was, for some time before the 1987 election, a parliamentary secretary, the first of the parliamentary secretaries, I think, and I may have not got quite that right. In late 86, I started to look after a group called the Australasian Police Ministers Council. And I first met Senator Tait because I used to arrange the meetings. And I think it was probably I met him in Hobart, at a meeting in Hobart. And he was the representing the Commonwealth. So I was doing that job when the 87 election came. And after it, I think that was the election after which Hawke decided to expand his ministry with parliamentary secretaries. And I think he did that originally because there weren't there was only a set number of ministers, and there had to be a change to some piece of legislation. I can't recall what it was. So for that period just after the election, Michael Tate was the Parliamentary Secretary for Justice, and he had a senior private secretary that from the department who provided him with services. When the requisite legislation was passed and Tate became Minister for Justice, the guy who was doing his senior private secretary's job decided he didn't want to continue to do it. And I got a call from a chap who was working in Tate's office named John Rao, who ultimately became, I think, the Attorney General in South Australia up until relatively recent times. And he called me and said, the minister would like to talk to you about the private secretary's job or senior private secretary's job. So I thought, boy, you know. So I came across to Parliament House. We were on the Senate side, almost in the far corner, West Block side. I think Peter Cook was in the corner and we were along the corridor there. And I sat down with him for, I suppose, 10 minutes. And he asked me straight out whether I'd be interested in becoming his senior private secretary. And I said yes. I do remember one finishing comment, which I wasn't serious, but it was an interesting. He said to me, Darryl, do you have a history of gluttony? Now, if you knew Michael Tate well, you knew that this was one of the seven sins. And I think it came about because when we were in Hobart, when I first met him, the ministerial council used to have a dinner. And it was usually a pretty lavish dinner. It was at the Rest Point Casino, so, you know, it was all that sort of thing. And I think he probably observed me drinking a little bit more than I perhaps should have. But it was not a serious question, but it was an interesting question, and I think highlights the sort of man that he is. So about a week later, I was in his office, and I served as his senior private secretary until 1992.
Yeah. Tell me, what was the structure and size of the office? We're talking about the years when you started. May have changed. I want to come later back to any changes that might have occurred when you moved up the hill.
We had essentially what was two rooms as the thing was set up. And so one room was the minister's office, and they put another door in the wall into the other office where 1, 2, 3, 4 people sat. I had a little cubby hole in the corner and the rest was open plan. There was a secretary receptionist at the front, a policy person who was at that stage was John Rao, the person I mentioned, and a chap named Adrian Wilde, who was the press secretary but also an active Labor Party person from Hobart who used to come to Canberra every week or whenever the Canberra office of the Parliament was sitting. So I'm pretty sure there were four staff.
Including yourself?
Including myself. And then not long after that, probably in the sort of November, I think we got another staffer who was again a member of Michael's office in Hobart, so I don't think that he was regarded as a member of staff in the strict sense. He was a member of the Senator's staff, but he came to Canberra when Parliament sat. So he was what I think we now call electorate officers, but he worked in Michael's Hobart office but came to Canberra. So we ended up with five by the end of 1967.
What was your formal role and your responsibilities?
Well, I ran the office. That was the role of the senior private secretary, was obviously managing the office from a, well, I would say from an administrative and policy point of view. I never got involved in any political stuff in those early days. That was looked after by Adrian Wilde, John Rowe, can't think of Daniels, the third person. So we had a, obviously in a minister's office is a process for managing all of the paper that comes through the office. And we used to have with Attorney Generals as the department, obviously, with the Minister for Justice, they used to operate on a colour process. So the coloured plastic folders that had the submissions and everything in them, ranging from red through blue, green, brown, and I can't remember. There might have been black. In fact, there were black, now that I think about it, because security stuff used to come over in black. So part of the Attorney General's remit was ASIO, so there was that. And while Michael didn't have a responsibility for ASIO, there was often things that came through. Our biggest part of the portfolio, of course, was the Australian Federal Police.
Hmm. So did all this paperwork come through you and you would allocate it to the, or pass it to the relevant staff member or to the...
Generally, not very much of that. I was the one who was the one who looked at everything and quite often wrote notes on the submission to the minister. I would say that might have been at 20-25% of the things. I would make a notation on the file on the papers that. And of course, one of the other things that I was a stickler for was the letters. You know, they had to be absolutely mistake-free. The number of times that we sent back letters because of spelling mistakes and that sort of thing, I think was a reflection on the people in the department more than anything else. But it was something that Michael Tate would have... He would have blown a stack if something had got through to him with a mistake in it, and he would have picked it up. So, you know, that was something that I learned very early on, that the quality control was a very important part of the job.
How would you describe your management style in relation to, you had four staff under your supervision?
Well, I'm a very inclusive person, I think. I must say that the relationships in the office have endured to now with all of those people. Friendships, great long friendships and all of those sort of things. So I don't know what that that means, a benevolent dictator. So I was actually, my nickname was Plenipotentiary. I don't know where it came from, but it was something that was the in-joke within the office. But
tell me, did you have any say in the appointment of the staff that were there, or were they already there?
They were already there, but subsequently, yes, I looked. The first personal secretary, a receptionist person, personal secretary, was a long-term... In my terms, anyway, she'd been with Michael for 7 or 8 months. We then, early in 88, we recruited a receptionist, and I personally selected her. She was somebody I knew, and I thought she was very, very good. So she came across. The staff then remained pretty the same. In fact, it did remain the same right up until we moved up the hill, and we expanded rapidly up there. And but I was part of all of that process.
Yeah.
I just wanted to add one other thing, which was, in a way, unique to Parliament House. In the corner of my office was a little box with a switch on it, which was a speaker, and it brought the broadcast of the Parliament into the office. And I used to sit in my office every day at 2 p.m. to listen to Question Time. Having been part of Question Time preparation every day, I mean, that was one of the biggest parts of my job, was at the beginning of the day working with the press secretary and the minister, going through what were the issues of the day, and by 9 o'clock I would have spoken to the department about the preparation of parliamentary question briefs on a range of issues. They all had to be back in our office by 11 o'clock. So